Welcome to OncLive On Air. I'm your host today, Ashley Wainer. OncLive On Air is a podcast from OncLive, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, OncLive covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, sponsored by Real Chemistry, we had the pleasure of speaking with Paul K. Pike, MD, about the use of dapatinib in patients with non-small cell lung cancer harboring MET exon 14 skipping alterations. Dr. Pike is the clinical director of the Thoracic Oncology Service at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, New York. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Pike discussed key findings from the Phase 2 VISION trial investigating frontline dapatinib in patients with non-small cell lung cancer harboring MET exon 14 skipping alterations, real-world data from the Together pooled analysis of dapatinib versus other frontline treatment options in this patient population, and insights regarding treatment sequencing with dapatinib in pretreated patients in this population. What are some of the current standard frontline immunotherapy treatments for patients with non-small cell lung cancer?
Sure. So the standard frontline therapies are a little bit heterogeneous, at least in the United States, and that's based on the approval of a number of different first-line IO regimens that really haven't been compared side to side. What I'd say is that I think many people, many providers in the United States do end up using pembrolizumab-based combination. So for those patients whose PD-L1 TPS is greater than or equal to 50%, many of us in a patient who's otherwise doing okay would use single agent pembrolizumab in the upfront setting. For those patients whose PD-L1 TPS is less than 50%, a lot of us will pair chemotherapy to pembrolizumab in a histology specific way. For squamous cell, it'll be platinum and a taxane. For non-squamous patients, that'll end up being platinum and hemotrexed, although again, there are other regimens based on ipilimumab and nivolumab, for example, as an IO combination. Sometimes folks will pin that to carboplatin paclitaxel as well, but my sense is that the use case for those regimens tends to be less common overall.
Talking about the kind of second line and later settings, what are some immunotherapy regimens that are typically used in the second line and later non-small cell lung cancer settings?
Yeah, so for second line, it's interesting. You know, the approval indications for immunotherapy for non-small cell lung cancer all happened in the second line setting and beyond. But with the emergence of the very good data in the frontline setting, that kind of went away. So that folks who end up getting immunotherapy in the second line setting and beyond, those patients tend to be those who did not receive immunotherapy in the upfront setting for whatever reason. It tends to be limited to that.
Can you briefly summarize the rationale and design of the VISION trial?
Sure. So the rationale for the VISION trial and then also its subsequent design was informed by work that had begun to emerge around 2014 and then published in 2015. Some of this was actually out of our group at Memorial that had identified MET exon 14 skipping mutations as actionable in non-small cell lung cancer. The initial data out of our group came with the usology of crizotinib as an off-label medication, which showed a pretty good response rate and median PFS. There's also some emerging data in a phase one trial of what back then was capmatinib, where patients retrospectively, their tumors had been sequenced and found to have MET exon 14 skipping who would end up responding in that trial. So those data end up informing the construction of the VISION trial, which was a phase two, essentially signal finding study, taking a look to formally assess what the efficacy of dapatinib as a selective MET inhibitor is in these patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer harboring MET exon 14 skipping alterations. So it was powered to take a look at objective response rate, although, of course, all the other survival metrics were looked at. And it was single arm, again, to try to find what the signal was in this population. VISION itself allowed patients up until sort of second or third line setting to receive dapatinib. So it was not power to take a look at individual cohorts the way that some other studies were, although patients were analyzed by lines of therapy. And the patients could go on also whether or not MET exon 14 skipping was detected through a liquid biopsy or a tumor biopsy. And so the data that came out afterwards to also took a look at liquid biopsy, the role of liquid biopsy in ascertaining response in this population.
What were some of the key findings from the 18-month follow-up analysis of VISION?
The 18-month follow-up analysis of VISION, which was presented and published by us last year, really built on the initial observations that have been reported in 2019 and published in 2020, which is that as time has gone on and the sample size has increased and the data have matured, the efficacy has actually gone up overall. So the overall response rate was just north of 50% in the entire cohort of over 300 patients, which was nice to see. Median PFS ranged between 11 to just north of 15 months, depending on line of therapy, and that was pretty stable. And median overall survival also was just shy of 2 years, so around 20 months for the entire population. Again, which was really great to see as the data matured. There were other data that we had presented, which had to do with lines of therapy breakdown. So the efficacy seemed to be somewhat better in patients who were treated in the first line setting than in the subsequent line settings, particularly with regards to response rate. Although again, PFS and overall survival were fairly stable in that second line setting and beyond. So in summary, the 18-month follow-up built on the prior data that we had presented and really both showed an improvement in efficacy overall, particularly as it relates to overall response rate and the real stability in the survival metrics.
What did the together pooled analysis findings indicate about the real-world efficacy of first-line tepotinib versus other frontline treatment options in patients with non-small cell lung cancer harboring these MET exon 14 skipping mutations?
Sure. So the together pooled analysis, which was presented as a poster last year at ESMO, was an analysis that both EMD Sirota but also some investigators had taken on to try to figure out in a real-world setting what the relative response and efficacy of other therapies were compared to MET inhibitors in patients with MET exon 14 skipping mutations. So the reason for this is because in the sort of pivotal trials for immunotherapy in particular that were conducted in the late 2010s, patients were not prospectively sequenced for MET exon 14 skipping. So we don't actually know what the efficacy of these standard regimens are in that population. So by taking a look at real-world data, you can sort of ferret that, understanding that there are limitations to real-world efficacy analyses. And so what they ended up showing was that the efficacy for frontline IO-based regimens, this is either IO monotherapy or IO coupled with chemotherapy, was pretty poor, both in relation to tepotinib, but also sort of all cross-trial comparison to what the aggregate data show for KEYNOTE-189, for example, or KEYNOTE-024, which would be the pembrolizumab-based regimen. So the overall response rates were in the mid-20%, and the median PFS values were really south of 6 months, which is not very good for a frontline regimen. Now, we got a sense that this would be the case based on some retrospective data that our group and others reported, suggesting that immunotherapy doesn't work very well in patients whose tumors harbor MET exon 14 skipping alterations for reasons that we don't really understand. So the real-world data sort of underscore that that's the case. In comparison to tepotinib, which again, response rates in excess of 50% and median PFS values between 11 to 15 months.
What were some of the key findings from the analysis of treatment sequencing with tepotinib in pretreated patients with these MET exon 14 skipping mutations? And, you know, how did the agent perform compared with standard treatments?
Sure. So another way to get at the relative efficacy of different regimens in this population is to take a look at the experience of the 300 plus odd patients in the VISION study, again, sort of retrospectively and through investigator assessments of what their responses were and the duration of response was for these patients treated with other regimens. And so this poster was presented at World Lung last year, which had shown what the relative efficacy was, again, by investigator assessment for patients treated in the upfront setting with IO-based regimens, and then subsequently what their treatment's response was for largely chemotherapy after progression on tepotinib. And in both sets of analyses, the results weren't that great. So again, the median PFS or the sequencing data for upfront IO-based regimens hovered between 4 to 5 months in comparison to tepotinib, which again is between 11 to 15 plus months. And then afterwards, for those patients who were treated with chemotherapy largely, some of these patients with immunotherapy after tepotinib, the median PFS was between 2 to 3 months. So very short window on which the patients were treated. And so that data combined just suggests as a foil that tepotinib is really quite effective in this population. So when it's sandwiched between first line and subsequent line therapy, it really kind of stands out that it's quite effective as a treatment option.
What are some safety considerations with tepotinib that are important to note?
Sure. The main safety consideration, and what I'd say would be the quality of life consideration, maybe more quality of life than safety, is the high rates of peripheral edema in this population, which we presented and talked about before. For reasons that are not entirely clear, though some of us have some particular hypotheses for this, most patients will end up developing peripheral edema. This tends to be grade 1 or 2, not too many grade 3 of adverse events. But because this population happens to be elderly, a lot of these patients are in their 80s when they're diagnosed with this disease and have other comorbid conditions or less mobile, peripheral edema, where you can't put your shoes on, for example, tends to have a larger quality of life and safety impact in this population. So that's the first thing to note, and probably the most important thing to note, that providers will see and patients themselves will experience. The median time to onset tends to be 2 months, so it takes a while before this edema presents itself. And we're not very good at combating it. It's not an edema that's kind of third spacing from CHF. So Lasix and other diuretics tend not to work in this setting. So we focus more on lymphedema-based treatments, leg elevations, compression stockings, referring patients to the lymphedema clinic. And in most of these patients, they will require a dose hold for some period of time to allow the edema to reset, and sometimes with a dose reduction as well. There are other adverse events that emerge in the trial data, although these happen to be smaller frequency and tend to impact quality of life much less than peripheral edema did.
From our conversation today, what is your main message for colleagues regarding the optimal use of tucatinib in patients with non-small cell lung cancer?
As time has gone on, the optimal use of tucatinib in patients with advanced non-small cell lung cancer has solidified both as the data have matured in the 18-month follow-up analysis, but also as other data have emerged for the real-world analysis of the TOGETHER study and also the sequencing analysis, that in this particular population of patients with an exon 14 skipping, tucatinib and other selective menin inhibitors have really the best efficacy that we've seen, both as it relates to response rates, but also the time-dependent efficacy metrics. And the most important one for me, I think, is median overall survival, which again is just north of 20 months, so almost 2 years in a population, elderly population, probably where first-line therapy gets median overall survival less than 10 months. So there really has been quite an improvement in these efficacy metrics for the use of tucatinib in this population.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air, sponsored by Real Chemistry. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On X, follow us at OncLive. On Facebook, like us at OncLive, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms, so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.